measure the individual elements of a three-element Yagi on 902, 915 megacycles, let's call it. As I hold the copper piece of tape on the end of this wooden stick near the tip of one of the directors, let me drop. I'm adding capacitance to that director. Its tuned frequency is going down, and I'm watching the display. Or if I hold the copper tape near the center of the director, I'm canceling some of the magnetic field, and the frequency goes up. So with my tuning tool in my hand, I could make each director, each reflector, each driven element go up or down in frequency, and I watch the display. Most of the time, when you tune the Yagi for maximum gain, the Viswa is terrible. Or if you tuned it for best Viswa, you lost some gain. So in other words, the average way you hold a piece of tape near the element of an antenna, the blue curve, meaning gain, goes up a little bit, but the yellow curve goes up, which is bad Viswa. So you're continuously tuning to get the blue curve to go up, that's gain, the yellow curve to go down, that's reflected signal, called Viswa. Once in a blue moon, you found a magic place to put down the piece of copper tape where the gain went up and the Viswa went down simultaneously. That's pay dirt. You say, I don't know what the hell's going on, but I'm going to keep doing it. It's working. You keep doing that over and over again, and you get the weirdest looking three-element Yagi you have ever seen. You go to that particular patent, and you look at that three-element Yagi. I mean, here's a guy who, in 2003, 2004, re-patents a Yagi and gets that patent issued. And you look at the shape of that antenna, which is now being manufactured. The weirdest looking shape in the world. Very fat elements, bulbous objects on the end of each of the elements, bunch of holes for the elements, weirdest looking shape. And you'd like to say to yourself, where in the world did that come from? Let me drop. It came from pure tinkering. Hours of tinkering of that testing procedure I just described to you. Once in a blue moon, each time you found a magic place where you put down the piece of copper tape onto the antenna. The antenna itself is a sheet metal. It's a copper antenna on a piece of vellum. It's a printed circuit antenna, so to speak. And so you keep finding the place where you put it, and the antenna keeps getting better and better. I eventually came up with a Yagi, which has 6.0 dB of gain over isotropic continuously from 902 to 928. And the Viswa is better than 1.15 across that whole damn band. 25 dB reflection coefficient. That antenna was impossible. It violates all the rules for Bode-Fano impedance matching. It violates the two-wheeler criteria for best bandwidth you can get out of an antenna in a given volume. It violates all those rules. This very fat, funny-looking three-element Yagi solved that problem. And it's been now in manufacture for over 10 years, so to speak. Thousands of the damn things. Take that antenna, that final design, derived by pure tinkering with a well-tuned vector network analyzer made by Roden Schwartz. You take that design and you plug it into high-frequency structure simulator. That's a $30,000 modeling program. Or you go to CST Microwave Studio and you plug in that antenna. And each of those modeling programs say, yeah, that's a medium good antenna, nothing great, nothing to write home about. The modeling program cannot handle that real antenna. The currently available modeling programs cannot handle that. Now you see why I've got no faith in modeling programs for my environment. Let me drop. The reason why the modeling programs can't handle it, the modeling programs are designed for thin element antennas. And I'm building fat element antennas. The finite element analysis has to break, the program has to break the antenna up into a zillion little bitty triangles. It has to calculate the exact signal strength and the exact phase angle of the signal that's in the middle of each one of those thousands of triangles on this fat antenna simulation. The program can't handle that number of finite elements simultaneously in a complex manner and being able to invert that complex impedance. The program takes hours of calculating to come up with a mediocre answer. And when I'm tinkering with a testing tool in front of a vector network analyzer, I'm getting the answer every 30 milliseconds displayed on that screen in real time, and no post-computer optimization is required. the real answer is there in real time. The computer modeling program, if it could handle it, would take hours of grinding on each time I made a change. You can see why I've lost all faith in currently available computer modeling programs, and yet every antenna manufacturer brags about the fact we model it first and then we build it. They will never find that whole class of antenna designs that I'm talking about. Ain't that crazy? That's another strong... In my mind, it's another strong example of the way we teach antenna design in our colleges, and the way it's practiced in the real world are almost completely disconnected from each other. There's a huge need for improvement in the teaching process. We do not teach antenna designing techniques in our colleges, in my opinion. It is a 60-year, what's the word for it now? They're stuck in the paradigm for 60 years. They're unwilling to change the way they teach the subject. You have to first admit there's a problem before you can make an improvement. Because of the 60-year tradition, they cannot admit there's a problem. I see essentially no evidence they're making any change. We amateurs are becoming the antenna experts on antenna design. The guys coming out of college, they've got some basic information. Until they've got 10 years of apprenticeship of doing what I call the ham radio approach, they will never be a real antenna designer, in my opinion. W2LYY, K2LYW, been there, done that. And each time I tell any antenna designer what I've done, how I've done it, why I've done it, they look at me with a blank stare. It is so foreign from everything they've ever heard before, they assume I'm crazy. Joe, you're listening to a crazy man. W2LYY, K2LYW.
Well, that means we're all listening to a crazy man. And I guess this is the closing question going down this topic. Being that you design something like this, I guess it's true with anybody making something, well, especially with you, being that you had to make the thing with certain exact physical dimensions using a certain exact material, were you able to duplicate the thing to a very small percentage of performance with your production models? Back to you.
Yeah, there is a company in Taipei, Taiwan, that is able to manufacture thousands of those things with real good holding of the parameters. The final antenna consists of a piece of sheet metal cut with this exotic shape with fat elements on the dipole, on this three-element Yagi. I think the darn thing is around 4 inches wide, 4 inches front to back, and 0 inches thick. And the whole thing is also bent over a cylindrical shape just to be done for beauty. It's got nothing to do with electrical parameters. And then it is molded with injection molded black plastic in order to hold it in just the right shape and make it look pretty when this antenna hangs on the front end of this handheld calculator-like thing. And so this company in Taipei, Taiwan, is able to manufacture thousands of them. And if I had to make a guess, I think they're getting a yield of 95%, if you know what I mean, Joe. Every so often the injection molding machine will give you a bubble. Every so often the injection molding machine will push the coax cable off to one side as this high-pressure rubber is being squirted in. So you get a few failures. But the antenna is being manufactured for, back in the days, a few years ago, I think it was being manufactured for something like $15 a piece. Every antenna manufacturer you would go to with that specification for that antenna in Viswell and gain versus frequency would say you're absolutely crazy. And as you said before, the guy who's positive it can't be done should get out of the way of the guy who's doing it. And so it can be done, but you have to use some very unorthodox techniques to get there. I fell into that because somebody went and bought that vector network analyzer. I used to hate vector network analyzers, but that particular Roden Schwartz is so well done, so user-friendly, and I started tinkering with it. I started looking at the results I was getting. I'm getting the results in real...
Repeater, timeout.
I'm getting the results in real time, instantly available results, as I make thousands of changes. I could test 50 separate antenna designs in a four-hour period. I only work 4 hours a day. I'm a semi-retired person doing consulting. And so in a four-hour day, I could check a large number of design by that technique, and I'm getting the answer in real time on that screen, and I'm watching it happen as I'm making the change. Why in the world wouldn't every antenna designer do it that way? And the answer is, the training they get is the exact opposite of that. And I could tell people that's what I've done. They don't hear it. Each person, just on a similar note, each person who has ever run a net, and I tell them, this is the advantage of running full duplex, where you can hear what's coming back out of the repeater. You know which of your words got through, when the machine is timed out, and whatever. I tell every net operator, there's a huge advantage if you run full duplex, and it's not that complicated. They all look at me with a blank stare. I've never done it that way. Why should I change now? As you can tell, each time the machine times out, I know exactly when it timed out. I know exactly what words to repeat. There's a huge advantage of running full duplex if you're going to be a net control operator. To my knowledge, essentially nobody does that. They don't even hear me when I tell them the advantage of doing that. So both in antenna design and net operations, I can say my words and people don't hear them. I think you're hearing me, Joe. You seem to be one of the few people that's hearing me. W-H-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, you're another real dipole designer, Joe.
Well, I'm getting there. And that subject you emailed me about, that might be a nice subject to bring up just in general as a subject to talk about. One term you used in that email I'm familiar with. You don't have to go into it here. But the second one I'm not familiar with. But that might be good to discuss that, those two terms and what they related to as an interesting subject, maybe for like next week or something like that. And finally, I have a question for the space report guy, but I'll wait until the space report comes up and it's time to pop in with this question. Let me hit your
YY. 52JJ.
Blank JJ. Things like you got a question on the subject, go ahead, sir. Start off with your full call and name. My name is Dick.
New York 2, Juliet, NY2JJ. Name is John. Old call sign was KA2YIY.
Okay, you've got a question on this particular subject, John. Go ahead.
I do. Actually, a comment. 35 years ago, the School of Engineering at the University of Buffalo had a name for the process you're describing.
I call it tinkering. I call it ham radio. An empirical approach. What did they call it, John? At the University of Buffalo, I hope they had a good word for it. Maybe I'd ought to start using it. What word did they use, John? Go ahead.
Guy who used a pencil and paper to design something was an engineer. A guy who used a meter to test how it was working was a technician.
Yeah, those are essentially derogatory terms. The guy who's getting the real answer, your definition, is the technician. But if that technician has a little bit more understanding of what's going on behind the scenes, he has stared at the Brown and Woodward curves for a couple of hours and said, oh, man, I suddenly realize what the hell is happening. You take a real curious engineer with real, hardcore, traceable to the Bureau information, like those Brown and Woodward curves. That damn modeling equation that's in all the good books is useless if you're doing any real bandwidth of testing. So a guy with the right raw data as a curious engineer who then goes and does technician-like measurements, but he's doing it with some extra smarts. He knows what's going on. He knows a little bit about why that dipole becomes capacitive when he makes it shorter than the resonant length, why it becomes inductive when he makes it longer than the resonant length, why the bandwidth gets wider when he makes it fatter, why when he adds those crazy shapes by putting chunks of copper foil in various places when he drops it. His past technician as an intelligent technician is telling him which direction to go in order to get the improvement he's looking for. When you take that amount of knowledge of a guy who's doing antenna testing and improving, call him a technician. A little bit naive, derogatory. It's only got a small fraction of the story. By way of the college using those derogatory terms, you're telling the guy who's going to design antennas, do not do it that way. You'll be called a technician. But that so-called technician-like approach gives you the real answer to the highest fidelity and the least amount of time. And for somebody not to go down that road with a little bit of smog, because it has a derogatory name to it, is really cutting people off at the pass with a potential damn good solution and telling them not to take that solution. Can you see the disadvantage of those words being used that way, John? NY2JJ, K2RIW. That, in my opinion, was an unintentional crime. You got it, John?
RIW, this is NY2JJ. Actually, I believe it was an intentional crime, and they were, in fact, trying to discourage people from taking that approach. But as you have empirically demonstrated, your way works better. Perhaps you should help them modify their teaching approach by going into teaching.
John, if you and I today went into teaching and we tried to change the curriculum that is dictated by 60 years of tradition, we try to change the curriculum of the way fields and waves and Maxwell's equations are taught, boy, you're up against a stone wall. They have to first admit there's a problem before they will allow a change. They don't think there's a problem. They're positive they're teaching the bedrock of antenna design of RF engineering by that technique, which in my opinion almost doesn't work. But that's my opinion. All students are led to believe these days that computer modeling is the be-all, end-all. For 90% of the applications of computer modeling and computer-aided design, it does a beautiful job. But the extremely unusual high-performance requirement for RFID antennas, which have to have 6.0 dB over isotropic gain, no more, no less if you don't want to waste capability, but no more if you don't want to violate FCC rules. So you're looking for 6.0 dB of gain of isotropic, and you're looking for a Virzwa curve that everyone thinks is impossible, and yes, it is impossible, by the previously used techniques. Therefore, they think computer modeling is the be-all, end-all. Not in that environment, not in that application. And the computer modeling programs fail miserably. The equations that give you the impedance of a dipole for that environment fail miserably, and yet the tinkerer, the so-called technician approach, gives you the answer in the minimum of time with the highest fidelity, but it's being expressed as a derogatory statement. Let me drop. Derogatory statement telling people not to go there. You take a naive engineer coming out of a modern-day school who thinks computer modeling is the be-all, end-all.
You're repeating yourself.
And he plugs in the numbers for a particular antenna, and the computer program predicts to him he's going to have a null of minus 800 dB. And he believes that number. The computer program said so. Any reasonable engineer looking at minus 800 dB says, no way in hell. But the computer program said that because it came close to dividing by zero. And they believe that number. The real world versus the way it's taught, a lot of improvements required. The next person on our list was, let's see, I guess it was John, Whiskey Kilowatt 2 Juliet. John, are you still there? Hope we haven't put you to sleep. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N on RFID, one quick one.
W3HYW, see what a quick one on that subject.
Okay, Paul and NYC, I think it was in that order. Go ahead, Paul, first.
Yeah, last week I finally sent you that picture about the RFID scanner that went to the ISS. I wonder if that's the one that you were involved with. They did say it came out of Long Island somewhere. I think they said Bohemia. I wonder if you saw that back there.
Yes, I did, Paul. And I only vaguely knew about that program, that company in Bohemia. And that's not the one that I worked on. And so they chose another brand, I'm sorry to say. And I can sort of understand that. The particular brand that I worked on, the good news is that it's got the longest possible range, almost 24 feet of range of reading a tag, whereas many of the other ones will measure tags between 6 and 10 feet, so to speak. 24 feet can measure under ideal conditions. However, it's got this homely-looking antenna sticking out in front, and for a space environment where you want a nice, compact, pistol-grip, computer handheld-like thing, that antenna sticking out in front by 4 or 5 inches probably turned them off. The fact that it's higher in performance and that it can tolerate the drop testing like crazy, they didn't look at those parameters. They looked at the beauty of the one they're using, which is a hell of a lot more compact, even though it's lower in performance, it met their requirements from their point of view. So that's what I think happened. Thank you for that information, Paul. The other person who had a question on this subject of RFID-like antennas, I think it was something like NYC. Correct me on your call and your name, sir. K2LIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Hello, Dick. Name is Don, Delta Oscar November. Call is Whiskey Alpha 2 India Whiskey Charlie. Thank you very much for a phenomenally interesting talk about that. I really enjoyed it. I doubt that I'll ever understand it all, but I learned a lot. But I have to ask what you might consider a very ignorant question. You did a hell of a lot of work to make this happen. And you, as brilliant as you are not going to put up your nose at an easy way out of a problem if it makes sense and it works. So I never heard you mention anything about trying any designs such as log periodic designs or something, which I would have thought might have gotten you out of a jam a hell of a lot easier and a hell of a lot less time. So I'm just curious as to why and how they failed you. And I just can't help asking that question.
Yeah, Don, that's an extremely good question. And by the way, there were no dumb questions on the TechNet. I went down that road at first. Tried all of the pot. I own 10 or 15 books on the subject of printed circuit, compact, microwave antennas. And I tried many of those designs. None of them came close to our requirement. The traditional designs cannot do it. So I looked for a better approach. And what you think was a hell of a lot of work really wasn't. Real modern-day antenna design is a list of rules of thumb based on your experience that work for you. When a guy is tuning his dipole in the backyard and he's scanning his rig from 7.0, 7.1, 7.2, 7.3 megacycles, and he's plotting that standing wave ratio curve. He's finding out where the antenna is tuned, or if he's got an antenna analyzer, he's measuring the resistor from the reactive component, he's measuring the real impedance of the antenna. That's based on his experience, his rules of thumb that work for him. I was doing that. This was fun work. I made it sound like it's a miserable work for thousands of hours. Not at all. The actual tuning of that Yagi, when I finally got down to the right process of doing it, was a couple of days worth of tinkering. And when I finally started filing for the patent on that antenna, I was so excited about the high performance it got. By the way, let me drop. The performance displayed on that screen of extremely good visual for a lot of megacycles. We didn't believe it. We assumed it's some kind of an error built inside of the Rodin-Schwarz vector network analyzer. So therefore, we went and retested it on a Hewlett-Packard, a Agilent, a Avantech. We got the exact same answer on all network analyzers. Then you connect it to a real RFID reader, and you say, hey, this thing is really cranking. It's really working. It's not just a false alarm, if you know what I mean. When it comes to writing the patent for that particular antenna, I get so excited about doing that. I started at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday. I finished writing the patent 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday. Worked around the clock 24 hours. And that created a problem. Because the security cameras in the building showed this crazy guy at 3 o'clock in the morning going to a candy machine. And the guy looking at the video tapes, the security tapes, says, who the hell is that? What is he doing? And that created a huge investigation as to why was that guy there at that time doing that. Reminds me of what I did out at the anechoic chamber in the Edwards Air Force Base. Again, I worked around the clock and it drove the security people crazy. They hadn't seen the high security badge come back to their station for 24 hours and they assumed someone had stolen it. And so this female guard found me in the men's room at 7 o'clock in the morning and she had to see that badge. So, people who get excited about what they're doing sometimes create problems, as you can see, John, Don. But it was fun all the way. I didn't know I was involved in a breakthrough. I was doing something that was working. It wasn't that difficult for me. Let me drop. And so as a pure ham radio tinkerer, so to speak, when something works that well, operates that fast, gives you results that good, gives you accolades from the company you're doing the work for so well, I was treated every day when I went into that company as a guest, I was treated as a guest. I was treated very well. They assumed that I could walk on water. The company I was working for had very few real RF engineers, and therefore, when somebody had that skill, they assumed that the person had made a Faustian bargain, if you know what I mean. He's dealing with a black art. Antenna design is not a black art. We teach it that way. I know we can teach it much better. You might have some further comments on this one, Don. Can't even read my own writing. IWC, I think it is. W2 IWC, or Don, you know who you are. K2 IW.
Well, thanks a lot, Dick, and I appreciate your answer. I guess it brings up the question of, are we being duped with the idea of log periodics or disc cone type antennas or something like that? I know a disc cone would have never met your criteria, but I don't want to belabor this all night. You got a long net with a lot of people, so thank you very much. Thanks to a help of a friend, got an antenna up in the air today, and I'm able to hear the TechNet well now, and what a treat. Thank you, Dick. We're so fortunate.
Hey, you're sounding good, Don. That antenna's really cranking, and glad you're appreciating it. I just flew out of my mind a great thing I was going to tell you. My goodness, why in the world can I think of what I was about to tell you? Antenna design, as I said, is a hell of a lot easier than you think it is. It is not that much black magic. We're not teaching it the right way. Oh, log periodic. Log periodic has definitely got the bandwidth. That's the good news. Doesn't have enough gain unless you make it rather large. There's had to be a compact structure hanging on the front end of a handheld reader. There was no way of squeezing that antenna inside without compromising its performance. Let me drop it. A well-designed log periodic can cover a 10-to-1 frequency range. That's the good news. You plot the gain across that 10-to-1 frequency range, it's got a bunch of bumps and grinds to it. That's almost acceptable. But the standing wave ratio of any reasonable log periodic has great difficulty staying under 2-to-1 standing wave ratio across that frequency region. Very few logs stay under 2-to-1. Most of them will stay under 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. To meet this requirement, the antenna had to have a standing wave ratio of 1.15 maximum across that 26 megacycles of bandwidth, around 915 megs. 1.15. Standing wave ratio that low, reflection coefficient 25 dB down was the requirement. Your log periodic will give you a reflection signal that's 6 dB down. I needed 25 dB down. Your log periodic will give you a 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. I needed 1.15 maximum. Doesn't come close. Therefore, by the standard antennas, standard designs that are known, patch, log periodic, inverted L, and so on, all of the known standard designs don't come even close to meeting that bandwidth of standing wave ratio. In fact, that bandwidth of standing wave ratio by the so-called Chu-Wheeler criteria. Mr. Chu and Mr. Wheeler, Harold Wheeler, wrote a bunch of formulas way back in 1948 saying this is the maximum bandwidth you can get out of an antenna for this particular volume of antenna. Let me drop. That antenna violates those rules. The rules tell you, you think you're seeing that design. The rules tell you it can't be, but it's there. How did this all happen? Everyone who learns about tuned elements, an LC element for a filter, is told that high Q is very desirable, low Q is undesirable. When you're building a filter, that's absolutely true. When you're building the elements of the antenna, it's the opposite. You want the Q to be low, but high in efficiency. You want the Q to be low because the signal is being radiated. The Q is usually low because there's a series resistance in series with the inductor, so to speak, of your LC network. So low Q for building filters is bad. Low Q for building the right kind of an antenna. teach it backwards. Everyone understands it backwards. So they think computer modeling is going to do it all, and they think IQ is the right way to go. There's loads of articles of guys that are studying the way they're going to build the directors of a Yagi. Let me drop. Where they're worried about if I build it with silver-plated copper, or if I build it with raw copper, if I build it with aluminum, or if I build it with galvanized steel, if I build it with raw steel. They've gone and measured the Q of a dipole-like structure, the director of a Yagi, of those materials. And they thought high Q is good, it means there's no loss. They had it backwards. Had they made the elements very large in diameter, they would have ended up with very low resistive loss. They would have ended up with very low Q. The measurement criteria would have told them it's a bad way to build a Yagi. Again, they've got it backwards. Whenever you think you've got loss in your element, you put 10 watts of transmitter power into your antenna, you look at it with a thermal imaging camera, if it runs ice cold, you're home free. You think you've got loss in your antenna element, the only way the antenna can have real loss is get hot, because there's a resistance somewhere. If your thermal imaging camera tells you it's cold, you're home free. So, everybody's afraid of fat element Yagis. Almost all the Yagi designs that we have access to do not have fat elements. There's a huge advantage of fat elements. People don't computer model them because they can't. They don't test them because they believe low Q is bad. So this whole class of antennas that I've worked on for the last 10 years is essentially unknown. And the majority of antenna engineers, let me drop this. The majority of experienced antenna engineers that I tell this to, they look at me with a blank stare because what I'm telling them is so foreign to everything they've ever heard, they assume I'm crazy. You guys are listening to a crazy man. Let's see, the next question on our list, I think, was Whiskey Kilowatt 2 Juliet. John, are you still there? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, that's affirmative. I went to sleep and I just woke up a little while ago. I got a question. When you are listening, I listen sometimes on a regular ham radio on HF, the different frequencies. It could be shortwave and stuff like that. I notice that I get more RF, more receive when I'm just tapping on the center of the SO239 connect on the back of the radio. Now, if I screw on the antenna all the way, which I would happen to be using IMAX 2000, if I screw it on all the way, I notice the RF goes down significantly. Like, I wouldn't hear anything. Can you tell me why is that? WK2J. The name is John.
Yeah, that's an interesting experiment you've done, John. A random length of wire plugged into the center of an SO239 connector on most of the HF band, 80 through 10 meters, particularly 80 through 20 meters, will give you a reasonable signal strength, even though it's far from resonant. When you plug in your coaxial cable all the way, which means you stop this random length of wire characteristic, I mean, the center conductor touching but the shield not touching means you're using your total antenna as a random length of wire. Your particular antenna on the band you are listening to when you plug in the coax cable will, in general, give you higher performance if the antenna is tuned for that frequency and represents a good standing wave ratio at that frequency. If, for instance, I took a 20-meter Yagi antenna and I'm using it at 20 meters and I plug the shell of the coax cable in and don't plug it in, I'm going to get the best performance when I ground the antenna and I'm really using the coax cable in the proper manner. Let me drop. But now if I take that 20-meter antenna and I've set my receiver to the 40-meter ham band, where the antenna probably has a 50-to-1 standing wave ratio, if I plug in the coax cable the right way, my receiver is looking into a 50-to-1 standing wave ratio on 40 meters, because it's a 20-meter Yagi I'm listening to, I'm going to get poor performance. I unplug the shell of the coax cable. So I'm now using that transmission line and the Yagi as a random length of wire. And it can very easily have more performance on 40 meters than the antenna that's mistuned. So There's also the possibility that you're hearing other outer band frequencies that's moving your S-meter and giving you a phony response. So it's a good test that you've done. Interpreting it is not easy, but if your antenna really was high in performance and good impedance match at that antenna, you should usually get the best performance when the whole coax cable is grounded at that SO239. I wonder if that makes a little more sense, John. Over to you. Whiskey Kilowatt 2 Juliet, K2LAW.
Okay, so in closing, let's say I was at HF listening and I got S units of 9, and I decided to cut the antenna for that particular frequency. Would I get a larger S unit?
If the antenna is properly tuned for the frequency, properly impedance matched the frequency, you're going to get the highest performance out of using the whole antenna, with one exception. Almost every antenna you and I build, high-end performance, good match, has an antenna pattern. An antenna pattern has nulls in certain directions. If the particular signal you're listening to is in the null of the direction of the high-performance antenna, and you unplug the shield of the coax cable, so now you're using the transmission line and the antenna as a random length wire, untuned, but it doesn't have that null, you're going to get higher performance. So direction of arrival of signal is another one of the very many variables involved here. The simple test that you did, John, has got a whole lot of variables involved. Maybe that's the real world. Mother Nature usually works that way, John. I wonder if that helps. WK2J, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. So in closing, if I cut the antenna for the proper length and match it up to the frequency I'm listening to, I should get a better performance unless there's a null in what I'm listening to in the direction that the signal's coming from. If there's a null, then I disconnected the outer part of the coax cable. I would turn it into a random wire. I would turn the antenna into a random wire and then get a better performance in that situation. So I think I understand you totally. WK2J.
WH1O to comment.
Joe recognized, and John, you got the concept. So, real antenna patterns. In three-dimensional space, every antenna has got every real antenna has got some nulls in certain directions in three-dimensional space, depending on the angle of arrival in elevation or the ionosphere for your particular signal, the direction of arrival, the antenna pattern of your well-tuned antenna. In general, a well-tuned antenna is the best approach. However, most of our antennas on HF are pieces of wire, and wire is cheap. So even though you've set up your dipole to be east and west, that means it radiates broadside the best north and south, but you're going to have a null on the east and west. There's nothing stopping you from putting up another dipole at right angles to the first one. And even if they're at the exact same altitude, it doesn't matter. When they're at right angles to each other, they don't talk to each other. So at the same altitude up in the tower, I can have one dipole from east-west, another dipole going north-south, with two separate feed lines. And now I get the best of all worlds. The null of one is the peak of the other, and so on. And because they're at right angles, they don't talk to each other. That's one of many solutions that's not very expensive, that you could go down that road if you want to. Joe, W-H-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, just a comment on part of what we talked about there, about the taking the connector and putting it on the radio completely compared to just the center pin. I noticed exactly the same kind of phenomena when I had a single band 80-meter dipole hooked up outside with a 1-to-1 balance. It's up to your own coax, and I trimmed it, so I got the thing reasonably, good performance, 80 meters. Just receive-wise, it would receive all the amateur bands reasonably well, but when I went very, very far out of band, I'll give an example, listening to like 10 winches, which is like three times less the frequency or more than 80 meters, the performance was absolutely terrible as far as what you'd receive way down there. And as soon as I did exactly what he did, you pull a center, the shield off and allow only the center pin to touch the receiver,
the level come up phenomenally, almost like Deep Allen was shorting out stuff way out of band. So you might be experiencing something like this with something just not resonant that his frequencies weren't listening to. And like you say, when you use the entire antenna and the long wire antenna just by the center pin being in, amazing things can happen. I noticed that now with the simple one I just simply threw up on the roof a couple months ago, just a simple random length of like 50, 60 foot piece of wire. It received all bands from 10 megs going on down like gangbusters. Unbelievable compared to what I had before. I never tried to transmit it to it. Never tried to transmit it to it, but receive-wise, just like a 70, 60-foot piece of wire that's attached to the end of an open connection to a 50-ohm cable. No mashing, no nothing. It received like unbelievable. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm going to make a guess on this one, Joe. That 80-meter antenna used on Wind 1010, like you said, one-third or one-quarter of the frequency, may be represented because, let's see now, 80 meters, and you're at one quarter of the length, and if I looked at my mental image of the Brown and Woodward reactant curve at one quarter of the length, you probably had 2,000 ohms of capacitive reactance on the 80-meter dipole on one megacycle. 2,000 ohms of capacitive reactance, and the resistive component was probably 5 ohms. So you probably had a 500-to-1 standing wave ratio. A receiver is very forgiving of the biswah of an antenna up to a point. You give it a 500-to-1 standing wave ratio of the real 80-meter dipole at one megacycle, you're going to get some pretty bad performance. And then you remove the coax shell of the coax cable so that only the center conductor is connecting. And now you've got a random length of wire going to your 80-meter dipole, and it as a one megacycle antenna probably had a standing wave ratio of 10 to 1. You went from 500-to-1 standing wave ratio down to 10 to 1. It's not a perfect antenna, but to that receiver, a 10 to 1 biswah is very tolerable in the receive mode. You try to transmit it with 10 to 1 biswah, and your transmitter is going to go bunkers. It's going to say, self-protect mode, I'm cutting off that final stage. I'm not letting you destroy those transistors. You got to have a good biswah to transmit well. But receivers, to a point, are very forgiving. But with your 500-to-1 standing wave ratio, in my example, you push that receiver forgivingness a little bit too far. You see where I'm going in that one, Joe? Maybe 2LYY, K2LIW.
Yeah, I do. But it seemed like the Balin was having more of an effect than anything else because, as I said, even the 80-meter dipole would receive on 80. Well, actually, I think it was rated for like, It would receive on 160 somewhat, but I know its performance probably should be better. But it would receive on the other bands actually pretty good too, on 40, 20, 15, and 10, and the bands in between. It wouldn't do too bad. It didn't want to load up on those bands very easily without some additional help from the internal antenna tuner and radio. But this long wire, like I constructed, at least like from what I could verify, like 10 megs on down, it made a phenomenal difference. So. Antennas are a strange animal sometimes.
They're always strange, Joe. But if you're willing to dig in and figure out what's going on, it's an exciting field. And we amateurs are, in theory, the best antenna experts because we're willing to tinker. That's where an awful lot of the real good design is coming from. Let's see now, Rodney, if we haven't put him to sleep, KC2LXB. Rodney, you still there? K2LIW in the deck net. Okay, another person was Hank. N1YDY, I think it was. Hank or Chris? I think it's Hank. N1YDY, do you have a question for us? K2LIW in the deck net.
Yes, Dick. N1YDY here. I do. I'm not sure if it's been technically superseded by previous conversation, but the question I have also relates to the March issue of QST and the log periodic antenna that they have there. And I noticed that there's a design here for one, and I also have seen arrow antennas that are capable of doing 2 meter and 440 and elk antennas that are capable of doing those two bands. So my question is it better to have two yagis on the same boom that are 90 degrees different from each other, or is it better to have a log periodic in one whitey white?
Yeah, that's a darn good question. If you're talking about horizontal polarization, for instance, and you take, for instance, the Fenco 6 and 2 meter Yagi antenna, popular way back in the 1960s, 6 meters and 2 meters, there were elements on the same boom, and those two antennas worked beautifully on those two bands, and not very much interaction. So is it possible to design 2-3 different Yagis on the same boom with not much interaction? Absolutely. If you're starting off from scratch, it could be a fairly difficult design, and if it doesn't exist as a commercial product, getting your hands on one is not so easy. If you can tolerate cross-polarization, where you set the Yagi elements on one band horizontal and the Yagi elements on the other band vertical, now you have no interaction. You got complete freedom. As I said, the amount of interaction is nowhere near as much as you think. Another reason why people put elements horizontal and vertical on the same boom is because they're looking for circular polarization. I don't think you're going there. Now, a log periodic does give you a lot of bandwidth, but you don't get super gain out of it. I think log periodic rarely go above 7 dB of gain. And although they've got a huge amount of bandwidth, their visual is not great. Very few log periodics are under, let me pick a number, 2.5 to 1, 3 to 1, across the whole darn band. But they'll cover a 10 to 1 frequency region. It pays you money, it takes your choice. Each one of these 5,000 kinds of antennas that I believe exists, they all have their individual advantages, disadvantages, cost, size, weight, wind load, whatever. So we as good marketing people, so to speak, we should look at all the possible antennas for that particular environment and decide which one fits your requirement. And if you're willing to homebrew antennas, like for instance going to the website of Kent Britton, WA5BJB, Whiskey, Alpha 5, Victor, Juliet, Bravo. You go to the second or third page of his website, where he's got these so-called cheap Yagis, made out of coat hanger wire and slats of wood. For a couple of dollars, you can get a huge amount of performance on 6.2, 432, 1296, by following his very inexpensive, very high-performance Yagi designs. They're darn good. And bang for the dollar, you can't beat them. So if you're willing to homebrew antennas, there's nothing stopping you from building a whole lot of different antennas and then choosing the ones that you like the most. So there's 5,000 kinds of antennas, Hank. They each have their advantages. Some people love one over the other. Some people just love J-poles. Over to you, Hank. N1YDY, K2RIW.
Thanks, Dick. I was looking at the smart tissue, and on the cover they have a Yagi design that they claim is good for multi-bands at the expense of frequencies outside of the amateur bands. It's been optimized supposedly for frequencies within it. But again, my question is, you know, that's obviously a homebrew thing, really brewing something from somebody's instructions. And there just seem to be so many different things. My real question was, is the log periodic for multiple bands or for two bands a better way to go than to go with two frequencies on the same boom, which I assume that you could tinker and figure out a way to get both of them to have, if not low visuar, at least acceptable visuar. And one way do I?
Yeah, the log periodic that you're talking about starts on page 33 of the March issue, 2016. It's called a four-band UHF contest antenna, 220 to 1296. And when you look at the curve, the antenna has some kind of predictable performance from 200 megs to 1300 megs. The good news about the log periodic is it gives you essentially continuous coverage. Throughout most of that band, it's under 2 to 1, with a couple of spikes of 4 to 1 and 5 to 1, and so on. So the good news about a log periodic is it covers the frequencies in between the bands. You can't stop it from doing that with most designs. But the log periodic, I don't know if he claims what gain he's getting out of this thing. I'm looking for the gain curves. and don't see it. Most log periodics give you in the vicinity of 7 dB of gain, whereas an individual Yagi on bands like 220, 432, 1296 to get 13 dB and 15 dB of gain out of a Yagi on those bands is relatively easy. So with a lot less aluminum and a lot less wind load, let me drop. I can get you 13 and 15 dB of gain on the same boom length as this log periodic. And those individual Yagis, they're very narrow band. You only cover that particular band and nothing else per se. And because you as a guy doing contest work, this is a so-called contest antenna, you don't use the frequencies in between the hand bands. So that advantage of the log covering those frequencies with the disadvantage of low gain and a lot of sheet metal in the air means that it's an antenna. It may not be the ideal antenna for your environment. The good news of this antenna is one single antenna. You take it out of the box, set it up at your each one of your contest locations if you're a rover. And so if you don't want the best in performance, you know, 13 dB of gain, which sometimes you really need, this is a solution. Let's see, what's the total length of this thing? 48 inches is what I'm thinking. Yeah, around 48 inches, 4 feet. Within 4 feet on 432, guess I couldn't get you that amount of gain that I've been saying. What's the best antenna? Let me drop. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but what's the best antenna? It's a little bit like saying, will I be happier if I marry a blonde, a brunette, or a redhead? In all cases, there's a hell of a lot more variables involved than first meets the eye. So, I don't have anything bad to say about this antenna. I haven't built many log periodics, so I don't have a lot of experience there. But the fact that they're not fantastic on Vizwar and don't have a whole lot of gain, but there's quite a bit of material there, puts me off a little bit. But that's just me. You might be a log periodic. The fact that a log periodic can cover such a huge amount of frequency really turns certain people on, and they just love them. And it's an exotic-looking device, and it's not that difficult to duplicate. So I don't have an exact answer for what I think you're asking, Hank. Should you build this over something else? Maybe do both and do an experiment and come back and tell us what you found, Hank. N1YDY, K2IW in TechNet.
AC2QIQ with a comment?
Hank, first grade, Hank.
Well, I think you've pretty much answered my question. You know, it was the figure two where they talked about the various visuals and the various frequencies. Sort of an interesting looking plot. It's not terribly flat at all if you have a copy in front of you. But, gentlemen, I think you've answered my question, and Glenn, pick it up.
Yeah, very good. I just was listening to this, and just in the background, just my personal experience that on most of the VHF and UHF frequency bands, gain is really king. So, I mean, if you can get the Yagis with the higher gain and the lower VSWR, I think you're really, especially if you want to do some SSB work and some long-distance VXing on those bands where you really want the directionality, I think you really, the Yagis kind of the way to go. On the HF bands, though, on the other hand, if you wanted to cover 6 meters through 20 or 30, a horizontally mounted log periodic is really kind of king because you don't need as much gain. Let me let it drop for a second. Generally, with experience, I found that 6 meters to, say, the 20 or 30 meter bands that you can cover in one log periodic antenna, horizontally mounted at about, you know, say, 45 to about 75 feet in the air, have a lot of low projection where if you have a noisy station nearby, you can kind of rotate the antenna just to block out the slop you're hearing on the side and then make contact with the person you want off of the forward end of the boom. Which is a very nice thing to have with a log periodic because you're not shooting for maximum gain. You're just kind of trying to zoom in on the pockets where you want to speak to and block out the areas that might be giving you frequency nearby just to get rid of some of that side lobe interference and make the contacts that you want. So log periodics on HF are really great, in my opinion. Over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Glenn, when you were in Florida, in the lightning capital of the United States, Were you running large periodics down there in Florida? And were you happy with the way they work for you? Over to you, Glenn.
Yes, I was, Dick. And there again, I was running the log I was using there was a 10 through 20 meter. It was not the largest one in the world, but certainly I had it up on a 75-foot tower right in Flagler Beach. And that thing was wonderful. That was just, you know, round the clock, all day long, worldwide performance. And it was really wonderful. And it's, you know, the biggest advantage there is not so much the forward gain. It's much the, you know, you have somebody that's, you know, 3 to 5 kilohertz off running some power a few states away, and they're just blasting in, and you try to get a weak signal in front of you, and you just kind of rotate the antenna around, and you kind of filter them out, and then you can make weak signal contact. But really wonderful down there, and certainly no problems with lightning, just nice thick grounding rods, and really grounded the heck out of the tower stick. And never had any problem with lightning. KC2QIQ.
Now, when it comes to those side lobes, that you were able to take a strong signal, move it into one of those notches, and the main guy you want to listen to is close enough to the main lobe that you improve the signal to jamming ratio real nicely by taking a log periodic, rotating it until you almost nulled out the bad guy. Even a Yagi, you can do that with, Glenn. Every antenna has got a very complicated three-dimensional pattern. Almost all antennas have got nulls in funny places. And so even with a Yagi, in many cases you'd be able to rotate it, get the guy into one of the notches, the strong guy. But now, let me go back to something else you said. Damn interesting. A 75-foot tower in Florida. I am guessing that's a rather rare item. Florida, rather flat land. Not very many people have got huge amounts of land. How many 75-foot or higher towers in Florida did you know about? Were you of one of the 10 guys in the state doing that? Over to you, Glenn.
Believe it or not, in St. John's County, especially up around the Panhandle, through Georgia, Savannah, it's Louisiana, that whole area, there's a lot of hams around there, Dick. And a lot of big antennas, a lot of open area. Remember, you got land over there. So you find some pretty good antenna arrays in that part of the world. But I have to say, the real advantage to the log periodic on the low bands are you can cover 6 through 30 meter bands with a lot of wide range without a tremendous amount of antenna tuning. Where on the VHF and UHF, and that's just one antenna. You know, now, but if you're looking at multiple small antennas, in other words, you can take like a little 1296, a 900 megahertz, a 2 meter, and a 440, stick them up on ham 4 rotator, and you've got them all in one little cute little array, and cover all the VHF and UHF, and then have one separate tower for your for HF. So, yeah, I would prefer the Yagis on with the gain on VHF and UHF, but on the HF, you know, getting a lot of bands in one antenna. Because think about how many Yagis you'd need on HF, and they're monsters. Back to the K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, thank you, Glenn. Another way of looking at the ideal antenna for your environment, for your favorite band. When it comes to 10 gigs and above, almost everything there is horns and dishes, mostly dishes, because you get the most amount of wavelengths of effective capture area. Bill, AC2IS. Let me say a couple of words on what you were talking about. I can take any well-tuned antenna. In your case, it's I think it's a 5.8 gigahertz antenna. Nice high frequency. And in order to do a good job of weatherproofing the antenna, or in order to physically support elements of the antenna, you're tempted to use a great big blob of something like hot glue. So what you've discovered, which is something that's very predictable with experience, let me drop, is that almost any material that you use for weatherproofing at that higher frequency is going to have enough wavelengths of thickness that adds enough capacitance that it's going to detune your antenna. That's predictable. The amount of detuning is also predictable. There's a couple of experiments where you could find out that just by taking the raw piece of coax with nothing but the center conductor sticking out an eighth of an inch, and you measure on your network analyzer what impedance you've got, and now you put your blob of weatherproofing material the way it's going to be, and now you re-measure on your network analyzer what does the end of that cable look like, can by that test know exactly